Open your Bibles to John 13. John 13. What we're going to do is we're going to work our way through this very familiar text here, but since this is a missions class, we're going to look at the cultural angles here. And when we're done with our time in the Bible, what I want to do is I want to explore a little bit more today before we move on into reverse culture shock. I want to explore a little bit more the cycle of culture shock and give you a couple of practical things, a couple of practical areas of advice on that. All right, now we're in John chapter 13, and last week when we were in John chapter 6, do you remember what I tried to get you to do? When you read a text, don't just look at the action that's going on in the text. Don't just look at the words that are said in the text, but take a step backward and ask yourself, what is the principle that's being taught here? What is it that is being taught here? What is at the root of what's being taught? And once you discover that, then you can contextualize something by applying that same, because you know what the principle is, you can make it culturally relevant. And it may be in a different way than you see exhibited in the Scripture, because the Scripture was written to people who were of a certain culture at that time. So we talked about Jesus being what? The bread of life to the Jews. But if he would have gone to some other country like ours, he would have been the potato of life. We talked about that. Okay? Now we're in John chapter 13, and this is a good one. This is a challenging one. And let me begin at verse 1. It says, "Before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. And supper being ended, the devil, having already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God, rose from supper, laid aside his garments, took a towel, and girded himself." Now, a couple of things before we look at the actual event that's going on here. Number one, what I want you to notice is this is the Last Supper. In other words, beginning at John chapter 13 in the Gospel of John, all that you read here is done within a matter of hours of before his crucifixion. So you want to keep that in mind. 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17 of John, all of that is a time span that we don't know how long it actually took to say the things that were said. But what we do know is that within 6 to 8 hours of what we're reading here, Jesus would be arrested and taken to trial. And within 12 hours, roughly, he would be dead. Okay? So that kind of puts a different perspective as you go through these things. He's got his disciples gathered with him. They're in this upper room. They're going to celebrate the Passover meal, the Last Supper. And just a sidelight, and again, being a pastor, I can never just like pass these things by without wanting to explain them all. Verse 3, Jesus, it says, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, that he'd come from God, and that he was going to God. Three key things there. Where did I come from? Why am I here? Where am I going? All from verse 3. The three questions that all philosophers try to answer. What is philosophy? Philosophy is trying to grasp the meaning of life. Where did we come from? Why are we here? And where are we going? Well, verse 3 tells us the answer in the life of Jesus. Knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, he knew why he was here. The Father had given all things into his hands. He had a mission. He had a purpose. Secondly, that he had come from God. Where did he come from? He came from God. He knew why he was here. He was to have authority and power. He had a mission that he was on. And third, that he was going back to God. So knowing the answer to the three most basic questions of life, where did I come from? Why am I here? Where am I going? That freed him to do what he did next. And this is what I want to challenge you with before we actually look at the cultural relevance here. When you know the answer, and you do if you're a Christian, to those three questions, then you can do that which would seem impossible before you knew the answer to those three questions. In other words, resting in the fact that you are created in the image and likeness of God, you know that. You know where you came from. You came from God. He created you in his image and likeness, knowing that you were created for what reason? To glorify him. Your reason for existence is to bring glory and honor to God. That's why you exist. That's your primary reason for being created. And third, you know where you're going when you die. right? You're going back to be with Him. So you have the three questions answered already that all philosophers are trying to figure out. The thing that drives philosophy, the meaning of life. When you know that, when you know those three things, it frees you up to then do that which could seem radical or impossible for somebody who wasn't secure in those three areas. Somebody who didn't know the answer to those three things would not be at ease or confident or secure enough to do what Jesus is about to do. And so, because we know the answer to those three things, we can serve in the most radical ways. And what I want you to notice about it is the knowledge of those three questions and the answer to those questions gives you an ability to serve. It's an impetus to service, no matter how demeaning that service is. And you'll see what I mean by that in a minute. Everybody with me so far? All right, now. Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into His hands, and that He had come from God and was going to God, here's what He did, verse 4. He rose from supper, He laid aside His garments, He took a towel, and then He girded Himself. So you can picture Him. Now, you guys are all Bible college students again, so I know you know this. They didn't sit around a table like we do with chairs. Their tables were like this far off the ground, and when they had a meal, they sat on the floor around the table, and they leaned back. The picture that you see of Jesus and the apostles at the Last Supper sitting around the table, wrong. That's an inaccurate picture. They didn't sit at tables on chairs. They sat on the floor. It would be similar to like the Japanese culture or other cultures where you sit on the floor. Anyway, they would be sitting on the floor, and the way that they would be around the table was leaning back on one elbow like this. So your feet would be, the table would be here, your feet would be like this, and you're leaning back on one elbow. The guy next to you, his feet would be here, you'd be leaning back, and you'd be, you know, you kind of like talk like this. Okay, so this is how they were around the table. So they're around the table, and it says, he rose from supper, he got up, he laid aside his garments, in other words, he took out the outer garments that he had on, and then he took a towel, and then he girded himself. Now you understand what girded himself means, right? You guys know what that means? To gird yourself. Understand that the guys in those days wore like dresses. They wore robes, you know. They wore gowns. And to gird yourself, what you would do is you would, because you couldn't work wearing those kind of robes that they wore, what you would do is you'd reach down between your legs and you'd grab your garment that's hanging down, the back part of it, and you'd pull it up between your legs like a diaper. You'd pull it up between your legs tight so your legs were free, and then you tuck it in your belt. You pull it through your belt, and what you've just done is you've girded yourself. You've girded your what? Your loins. You've girded your loins. Now, what does that provide? That provides an ability for you to squat, to move, to stretch without having that long robe hanging down and flowing down there, you know, impeding your action that you want to do. So he got up, took off his outer garments, girded himself, pulled that thing up there. So his legs were showing, like a diaper. Then he grabbed a towel, and it says, verse 5, after that he poured water into a basin, and he began to wash the disciples' feet, and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. He got up, he did this, poured some water. They had to be going, what is he doing? Why is he standing up? Why is he girding himself? What's with the towel? What's with the basin? Why did he fill water? And then he begins to squat and wash their feet. This was radical. This would have assaulted completely their understanding of Jesus. This would have been so offensive to them, so inappropriate to them, that it would have been totally repulsive. It would have been repulsive. And Peter's the only guy that would speak out probably what all the other guys were thinking. Verse 6. He came to Simon Peter. Peter said to him, Lord, are you washing my feet? Jesus answered and said to him, what I'm doing you do not understand now, but you will know after this. Peter said to him, you shall never wash my feet. Jesus answered him, if I don't wash you, you have no part with me, Peter. So Simon Peter said to him, "Well, Lord, then not my feet only, but also my hands and my head." Peter, you got to love Peter. Verse 10, Jesus said to him, "He who is bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not all of you. For he knew who would betray him. Therefore, he said, you are not all clean." Verse 12. So when he had washed their feet, taken his garments, and sat down again, he said to them, "Do you know what I've done to you? Do you guys know what I've just done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am." You know, you guys have called me teacher. You've called me Lord. You have a respect for me. You honor me. You've recognized something in me that has drawn out, you know, your favor, your respect, your reverence. You call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. Do you know what I've just done? If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who is sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, happy are you if you what? Do them. Now, what's going on here? Jesus wanted to teach his disciples hours away from his arrest, hours away from his death, his last real encounter with them, there was something missing. There was something missing that they had not gotten yet. Something that they had not fully grasped yet. And that was what? The reality of service. That in God's kingdom, greatness is measured how? By servanthood. And so what he's going to do is he's going to give them a lesson on servanthood, but he's going to do it in a culturally relevant way. It's going to be a spiritual lesson about the principle of service, even demeaning service, to teach them a lesson that they would never forget. Now, what makes this significant is, when you look at the other Gospels, is on the way to this meeting, they were arguing about who's the greatest in the kingdom. Remember that. When you look at the other Gospels and you put all four Gospels together, you see that on the way to this Last Supper, they were cruising around talking, not where Jesus could hear them, about who was going to be the greatest in the kingdom, about who's more important. And Jesus has to stop and, again, reemphasize this fact of servanthood. So what he does here, if they haven't seen it before, he's going to teach them a lesson about servanthood that they will never forget. He's going to give them a lesson on servanthood that was so culturally relevant that it would be burned in their brains forever. They would never forget. And what was it? Washing their feet. Now, why did he choose this? And here's where we get to the root of this class. Why choose washing their feet? Okay, culture of the day, Jewish culture. If you had any money at all in Jewish culture, and this is the same in many countries around the world today, if you had any money at all, you would have domestic helpers that live with you, or we might call them maids, butlers, whatever. You would have domestic helpers that would help you run the household day to day. And generally speaking, domestic helpers were the people who were come from poor families. They were people that had no education. They were people who had no hope, no technical skills or whatever, and they would be hired by people that had money. They would live, usually, with the person in their house, and they would do all of those grunt jobs that were demeaning for the family members of that house. Everybody with me so far? This is still prevalent even today. It's this way in the Philippines. It's this way in parts of Mexico. It's this way in other countries around the world. Domestic helpers, Hong Kong has a huge population of domestic helpers from the Philippines, like 500,000 of them, Hong Kong Chinese, that have domestic helpers from the Philippines living there with them, doing all the jobs that nobody in the house wants to do, jobs that are below their status.
So this is the way it was at the time Jesus came. Now, the thing you have to understand about this is that there sometimes were more than one domestic helper in the house. The newest domestic helper that was there, the newest man, the lowest man on the totem pole, or woman on the totem pole, got the worst jobs. The worst jobs were given to those that had the least amount of status. And you know what the worst job of all the jobs that they did was? Foot washing. Because when somebody would come to your master's house, they all wore sandals. Remember, there was no sewage system. There was no septic tanks. In many of these places, they didn't understand the concept of sanitation, public health, and so forth. So people would defecate, you know, in places that were very public. And, of course, there was no asphalt and so forth on the roads. So when you're cruising around in that kind of situation, your feet get full of dust. And dust that's not pretty. It's not nice, clean dust like from a Southern California beach or even the desert out here at Borrego. I mean, this is like, ugh, disgusting dust where sewage and stuff is rampant and flies and all the other things that go along with that. So the lowest servant in that household, when somebody would come to call upon the master, the lowest servant's job, the most demeaning job, was to wash the feet of the visitors. His responsibility or her responsibility was to meet them at the door, to have a basin of water. The person would step into the house and they would wash their feet with their hands, washing off all that dirt and all that grime and all that stuff, and then drying their feet and then letting them proceed into the house. And again, this is common. Very few countries walk into the houses with their shoes on. We're one of those unique countries that do that. And our concept, and Heber brings it up in the book, the floor is dirty to Americans. To a lot of other countries, the floor is not dirty. You take your shoes off outside, you only go barefooted into the house. To sit on the floor is not necessarily dirty. If you drop something on the floor, you don't throw it away. One of the reasons we throw it away is because we have a concept in our culture that the floor is dirty. And it is, because we track in and out on it with our shoes. But it's very strange. When I go to a Filipino's house from my church, I go to their house and there's 15 pairs of shoes at the front door. Nobody goes in their house with their shoes on. But when I come, I'm the pastor, and I start to take my shoes off, they don't want me to take them off because they know, you know, A, I'm an American and I'm in America. But I take my shoes off anyway when I go into their house. It's surprising how long your carpets last when you take your shoes off and leave them at the door, and how seldom you have to have your carpets, steam cleaned or whatever. Interesting. But the point of it is Jesus says, look, I got to teach these guys servanthood. They still haven't gotten it. They were just arguing about who's the greatest in the kingdom. Now, I want to teach them the principle of servanthood. What is the most effective way I can do that? What is one way where I, by my actions, can demonstrate that greatness in my kingdom is measured by service and that we are to look out for the good of other people, no matter how demeaning it is for us, no matter how ugly it is for us? What can I do? I'll wash their feet. And so he washed their feet. And when he did this, it would have hit them like a ton of bricks. What is he doing? This is the Lord, the Master, the Teacher, this guy that can raise people from the dead, walk on water, calm storms, cast out demons. The guy that can cause fish to have coins in their mouths when you catch them so you can pay your tax. Wow. Look at what he's doing. It's so unorthodox. It's so radical. So he gets down and he starts to wash their feet. And when he comes to Peter, all the other guys were thinking about it. They had to be. Peter's the only guy that would say anything about, are you washing my feet? Foot washing is too demeaning. You will never wash my feet, Jesus. You will never. Why? Because that is a demeaning, disgusting, despicable job that's below you, Lord. You can't do that to me. I will not permit you to do that to me. This is how Peter perceived it. And Jesus said, what? If I don't wash your feet, Peter, you have no part with me. Peter, listen, man, you got to let me do it. If you really say you are of me, that you love me, that you're my disciple, then you got to let me wash your feet. And so he washed their feet. And then he made it clear that it was an object lesson. He said, you call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I've given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. And here it is, verse 16. Most assuredly I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who is sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, happy are you if you do them. Okay? Everybody with me so far? Now let's make it relevant. First thing we ought to understand, I already told you what the principle is he's trying to communicate here, right? And that is service is greatness in the kingdom of God, no matter how demeaning that service is. And it's always focused on others. No matter how defacing or demeaning it is for you, you do it to bless others for the glory of God. And because he's secure in knowing who he was, where he was from, what he was here for, and where he was going, he was able to do this. Now, if I, right now, got a bowl of water and went around and started to wash your feet, you might think it was disgusting. I think it's disgusting to wash your feet. But it wouldn't have the same impact on you that it had on me. I mean, that it had on those guys. It wouldn't have the same impact. Why? Because foot washing is not a culturally relevant thing for us to do. Matter of fact, I mean, a lot of you ladies in here have other, well, and some guys I suppose too, you have pedicures, right? Other people work on your feet, you know, cut your nails, do all that stuff that you do when you do a pedicure. I mean, to work on somebody else's feet is not that demeaning. Actually, it's a pretty good paying job in this part of the world. Okay? But you now are a missionary. And you want to communicate this concept of servanthood at the cost of being demeaned and defaced. Now you have to find something culturally relevant that would impact an American in the same way that these guys were impacted by foot washing. What would it be? Now I always ask my classes this when I teach this, so let's kind of have a little interaction here. What is the most disgusting, demeaning, no-brainer, despicable job in American culture? Okay, hold on. One at a time. Name one.
Scrubbing toilets.
What else?
Collector.
Trash collector.
Changing bedpans.
Changing bedpans.
Huh?
Changing old people's diapers. Older people's diapers. Yeah. Okay. Now, all those are good. I usually get stuff like working at McDonald's. Some people, it's like working at McDonald's is like really a despicable, demeaning job. That's a real American view on things. But anyway, some of the best ones I've heard, probably the pinnacle one that always gets the best response is the guy that pumps septic tanks. You know, the garbage man, that's a pretty bad job too. That's a pretty good paying job. You know, the people that can't get any other jobs pump septic tanks. You know, so anyway, I don't know. We don't have, because of our culture, and it's so utilitarian and so task-oriented, we don't have one thing that is like the lowest, most demeaning thing you can do. But you guys are in the category cleaning a toilet or whatever. Okay? Now, the point of it is, though, if you're going to be culturally relevant and you want to teach servanthood in a real practical way, you as the leader, as the representative of God, would have to do that, whatever that thing is, for the people that you're trying to teach this lesson to. Something that would be so radical for you in your position to do that it would totally blow them out of the water. So, think of it like this. And I don't say this to be demeaning to the Lord at all, but as you know, Americans are really big on restrooms being clean, right? Okay? I don't know why. It's just one of our American cultural traits that whenever my wife or any other woman that I know finds out people are coming over to visit, the first place she goes and cleans is where? The restroom. I don't know why. Americans have this phobia about dirty bathrooms. Most of the rest of the world, the bathroom's the place you relieve yourself. In the Philippines, it's called the comfort room, the CR. It's who cares what it looks like? Who cares what it smells like? I mean, it's the place you relieve yourself. If you've got extra money or extra time, you clean the living room. You know, you clean the kitchen. You put your money into those other things. That's just the place you relieve yourself. But we have this phobia about bathrooms. Now, picture Jesus coming to your house and you go in the restroom and use the restroom and the toilet clogs with your stuff in it. And it overflows all over the floor. And Jesus comes and knocks on the door and you're in a panic, opens the door and says, "Step out of the way. I'm going to clean this up." How would you feel? You know, how would you feel? And then he would gird his loins and he'd get down on his hands and knees and he'd get the plunger and plunge your toilet. And then when he was done, make sure it flushed right again, he'd mop the floor, wipe it up, you know, and then go back and sit down in your living room. And everything within you would say, "No, Lord, don't do that. I can clean it up. I can clean it up, really." No, if you don't let me do this, you have no part with me. How would that feel? Cross-cultural ministry. Cross-cultural awareness. He's taken that which is demeaning and disgusting, and he's done it for you. And you have to receive it. And then he says, "Now I want you to have the same attitude, to represent me properly." Powerful stuff. He's radical. You say, "I'm your master." You call me teacher and Lord. You say, "Well, so I am." And then he turns around and does this. Everybody with me? This is powerful stuff. Now the point of it is, for this class, is you've got to know the culture before you can demonstrate service in that culture. What may be an act of service to you in your culture may not have the impact on the people that you are doing, that you are ministering to. Okay? You see? In the Philippines, the two demeaning jobs are, one of them is a jeepney driver. They make fairly good money, but driving a jeepney, public transportation, it's like anybody with any education or any money or any status doesn't drive a jeepney. They're like lower realm status. And also these people called city aides. They're people that are poor, uneducated, and the government hires them. They wear these shirts, yellow t-shirts that say Cebu City Metro Aid, and they sweep the streets all day long, and the streets are filthy there. They have these long brooms, and they're out in that heat, that sun, cooking that tropical sun every day. They're out there sweeping for like 40 pesos a day or whatever. You know, $2 a day. And they're out there. And it's like, that is the most demeaning, disgusting job that you can do in that culture. And you, as the missionary, viewed as educated, viewed as a man or a woman of God, you're with your disciples there, and you go out and sweep the streets or drive a jeepney. And they would immediately grasp, this is radical. He's doing that which is defaming. He's doing that which is demeaning. How could he do that? This is too low for him or her to do that. Okay? Do you have a question? No? You're just stretching your arms? Okay. All right, so you guys with me? I don't want to beat a dead horse, but do you understand why he did this now? Because in that culture, it was the most effective way to teach this spiritual principle or the spiritual truth. Now, when you're going to go and you're going to minister to somebody and you want to demonstrate servanthood, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? You see? This is what our Lord did. And finally, in verse 16 or verse 17, he says, "If you know these things, happy are you if you do them." Sit here and say, "Yeah. That is a really demeaning job. You know, now that would be a good thing to do to demonstrate servanthood." There's no joy in that. You got to figure out what it is and then what? Do it. Do it. I remember when I had a job, the last job I had before I was in the ministry, I went in the ministry in 85. I delivered uniforms for mechanics, you know, shops and stuff like that. It was a good job. Teamsters Union, made a lot of money. Drove all around San Diego, but I had the South Bay route down by San Ysidro, by the border, and Chula Vista National City. And
you know, I mean, I was college. I was going to college at the time, you know, married, have a couple kids, you know, somewhat smart. You know, I thought I was okay. And I'd go into these mechanic shops, and I was the guy that had to deliver their uniforms. And, you know, mechanics a lot of times are kind of rough, scruffy kind of guys. You know, a lot of them are not really that educated or whatever. It's changing now because of the industry. But anyway, you go and you deliver shop. Well, one of the things that you have to do when you go in there, when you're uniform guys, you have to pick up their old uniforms. You bring their new ones in, but the problem is their old ones are laying there in a pile. And they're not like well kept. That's an understatement, okay? Their uniforms are not really like that well kept. They have dogs at home or whatever. So they got grease, they got tranny fluid on them, they got oil all over them, they have dog hair, cat hair, you name it, all over them. And the only way you can get them into your truck is pick them up like this and then take them out to your truck and dump them in the back of your truck. One of the other things you have to do as a driver is to pick up shop rags. You know those red shop towels that mechanics use? Well, they don't just use those to wipe their hands with. You know, there's other things that they use them for, like blowing their nose, this and that. And part of our job was we had to count the shop towels so we could give them the exact amount that they were turning in. This is how the business runs. So when you go there, all the shop towels are in a can, and you have to go through and pick each towel and count it. You can't estimate it because the company loses money. You're always going to end up giving them more towels than they've actually turned in, and you make money by they purchase the towels they wind up losing or the mechanics take home or whatever. But the point of it is you have to count these shop towels with, you name it, on them. Sometimes the bathrooms run out of toilet paper, and you know what's on the shop towel. And you're counting them, and it's a demeaning job. None of the mechanics want to do it, but that's your job. And you're educated, and you're smart, you know, and you're going forward. You've got a career, and you're down there counting these dirty, stinky, dirty, rotten shop towels. And it's demeaning. It's humbling. And to do that in front of them and demonstrate the heart of a servant and have joy in the midst of doing it is an incredible testimony. I can't tell you how many people I got to share the Lord with because I actually did count the shop towels right. A lot of the other drivers didn't. And just by doing it with joy as unto the Lord, because I was counting those shop towels for Jesus, you know, it opened doors for me to share the gospel. I got to lead a couple of my customers to the Lord in those days. Okay, so the point of it is, if you know these things, happy are you if what? Do them. It's not enough to know them. When you figure out the right way to do it, to express that spiritual truth, then do it. And joy will be the result. Not sadness, not shame, but joy, happiness. Okay? Everybody with me on that? All right, so we're going to leave it at that. The washing of the disciples' feet. Never look at that the same again. He picked the most demeaning, disgusting thing to teach them a lesson. And if you're going to be a good missionary, you've got to find out what's the most demeaning, disgusting way to demonstrate service to the people that you're going to serve in the field you go to. All right, so with that, we'll stop there in the Word. Now, have your pens ready, because what I want to do before we continue on in Hebert is I want to give you some practical advice about that disenchantment phase. Now, let me jog your memories what we're doing here, okay? What we did the last 2 weeks is we started to talk about culture shock. And as we were talking about culture shock, we talked about the things that cause culture shock. Remember that? Language, change in routine, changes in relationships, loss of understanding, emotional and evaluative disorientation. Those were the causes of culture shock. We looked at symptoms of culture shock, rising stress, physical illness, psychological and spiritual depression. And then last time, what we did last week is we looked at the cycle of culture shock. And keep in mind that on a short-term trip, you won't usually even have culture shock. It's all in the honeymoon stage. You stay in the romantic honeymoon stage on a short-term trip. This stuff is for when you're going to stay longer. But we looked at those four phases of the tourist stage, the honeymoon stage, but then that fades when you realize you're here to stay. You move into the disenchantment phase, then hopefully to the resolution stage, and then to the adjustment stage. We talked about that. Now, in the second stage, when the reality sets in that you're here, that you live here, and that you're not leaving, then All that which you used to marvel at is no longer marvelous. It's annoying, actually, and starts to wear on you, starts to grate on you. You get into this phase called disenchantment. And really, in that phase where you become disenchanted, and it's normal, every missionary goes through it, when you're in that phase, how you respond in the midst of that will determine whether you go home or whether you stay. It will also determine whether, if you stay, you'll be effective or not. Your responses. Now, what I want to do is give you proper responses during the disenchantment phase. These aren't in Hebert. This is stuff that I've picked up over the years from my own experience and other reading that I've done. Proper responses during the disenchantment phase. Here's number one. Active observation. Active observation. Now here, let me explain what I mean here. Active observation. When you're in that culture and you're starting to get disenchanted with the way things are, what you want to do is be an observer, but an active observer. Now a good analogy of it, and again, this is true in most countries, the way we drive here is very different than most countries. Our laws, generally speaking, our traffic laws are fairly well obeyed. You have lines on the streets for lanes, and people stay in their lanes. You have stoplights that people actually stop at most of the time. And signs, I mean, the signs are so well lit up. The signs are so well done visually. They're so spaced right where, you know, you've got a mile before you get to the exit, then a half mile, then a quarter mile. I mean, you don't find this in most countries, okay? This is America. I mean, we are the culture of cars, too. It feeds our independence and individuality. But the point of it is that when you drive here, and I'm sure you guys have driven enough to do this, and I've done it I don't know how many times. You go through an intersection, and then after you're already through it, you have this thought, was that light red? Have you ever had that thought? Did I stop at that stop sign? I mean, you're just, all of a sudden you have this thought like, man, I can't remember if I went through a red light or not. Well, I guess if I did, there'd be a cop behind me. But, you know, we drive here passively. We observe, we don't even pay attention to our driving here. We're listening to the radio, we're talking to somebody else. I mean, driving here is so orchestrated and so organized that your brain can be 1,000 miles away while you drive the car. You're not even thinking about driving while you're driving. You're not even paying attention. You just drive by reaction, by response, by, you know, you don't pay any, there's no visual observation necessary to drive here. When you drive a lot here, you just drive mechanically. When you go to another country, Mexico, for example, Philippines, oh my gosh, you cannot drive like you drive here. Because people are everywhere, cows are everywhere, people are darting out. I mean, to drive there takes constant attention. Your mind has to be engaged in the fact that I am driving. You're constantly looking around, and most of the time there are no street signs. So you're looking for landmarks to know where to turn at. You know, and you've got a little kid that, you know, is playing over here and they just walk right out in front of you, or some old farmer there is with his carabao and he just pulls right out in front of you with his carabao. You're driving and people are cutting you off and everything. When you drive in a third world country, it takes active observation. You make a conscious choice of your will to pay attention, because you let your mind wander for 10 seconds, you're going to kill somebody or you're going to get hit or whatever. It's a stressful thing to drive in foreign countries. There's no stress involved in driving here. I used to teach a sermon on this about the analogy between driving and prayer. You know, a lot of Americans' prayer life is like the way they drive. You know, kind of passively, just do-do-do-do-do-do, kind of mechanical. When you go into a cross-cultural environment, your prayer and the intensity of your prayer increases in the same way that your driving intensity increases, because you're in a battle. You're in a spiritual war zone. So your beepers are up. Your sensors are doo, 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 all the time. You're aware of spiritual things when you're in the foreign field in a way that you're not here. Here you just slough them off. You just go right on by them. You see? So the first thing, the first proper response is active observation. Not passive observation like like you did when you walked into this room this morning. See? Now, I think it was Sonia came into the room and said, the tables are in the back of the room today. Okay? I'm just using that as an example. Remember last week, they were going to use this room for something, and they came in before the class, and I think they knocked out the last four rows of tables. They took them away. Okay? Now, when I walked in, I didn't even remember that, and I didn't notice that. Why? I'm just kind of in my mechanical mode. I'm going to come in, get my stuff ready. I pass by stuff. I don't pay any attention to it. She comes in. She makes an observation. The room is set up the way it was the week before, last week, you see? Active observation. One of the things that helps you in the disenchantment phase of culture shock is to be an active observer, to look at something with attention. When you cross the border, how many of you have been to Tijuana? Okay. The first time you crossed that border, what were you doing as you drove down to wherever you were going? You're just like, oh my gosh, look at those houses. Look at the way they're built on the hill there. Look at the dirt on the streets. Look at the trash. Look at the colors they use on their houses. You know, hey, there's a familiar Coca-Cola. You know, what are you doing? You're actively observing the situation. Your eyes just aren't roaming around. Your brain is engaged. You see? And all of a sudden, it's interesting. You're marveling at the marvelous. The disenchantment phase, what it does is it brings you to the point where you stop observing actively, like you did when you first got there. So we have to make a conscious effort to observe, like when we're in a new area. When you first flew into L.A., some of you hadn't been to California before you got here for school. You fly into LAX or you fly into Joanne, and you're coming through L.A., especially if you come from L.A., and you go through Inglewood or those areas around the airport. You're just like, oh, look at this place, you know, and it's just, your sensors are up, okay? It's the kind of observation that, you know, you see those kids things where there's a picture and it says, find six objects. You have to hunt them down. You have to find them. What does it take to do that? Active observation. It requires careful looking. Okay? So what we need to do when we get into the disenchantment phase is the first thing is we need to come back and be active observers. Don't just get so discouraged that you're not leaving, that you're stuck here. Continue to force yourself to be an active observer. Now, that's the first step, but that's not the most helpful step. The next thing is interactive observation. First, you have active observation. The second thing is interactive observation. In other words, what you want to do is you want to become a participant observer. You want to be somebody who participates while they observe. An example would be, again, go back to Mexico, and this is part of the training that we do down there, is you get down there, and on your way down, you're usually with, you know, a group of other people in their car. And you look at those old American Chevy or Oldsmobile station wagons down there, they're taxis, and they're crowded with people. You see people stand alongside the road, and a ton of them get in, and a ton of them get out. The car can barely move and get over to bumps, and it's a Mexican taxi, and they're going all over town. Well, you've actively observed that. You notice the difference between their taxis and ours. You have to cross the line, though, where you become a participant observer, which means what? Get in the taxi and take it for a ride. Now, when you're in the disenchantment phase, you're engaging the culture then. You've actively observed. Now you've taken that step to become an active participant in it. You're an active observer. And what this does is it helps you to transition. It helps you to become familiar. And we'll talk about it later in Hebert today. He talks about the anxiety. The anxiety, the fear of not knowing what something is like or what's going to happen. When you're an active observer and then you become an interactive observer, you lose the fear because you've done it. You see? And once you understand the way those taxi routes are run in Tijuana, they're not scary at all. They're run on routes, just like the buses. See, you come in thinking they're taxi systems like ours. That you get in the taxi, you tell the driver where to go, and the driver goes wherever you tell him. That isn't how their taxis operate. Their taxis run routes, just like our buses do. Now, wouldn't that be helpful to know before you get in a taxi? Which route is this taxi going to be on? It goes the same circuit all the time. So if you're trying to get to this side of town, you have to take this taxi and get off at this stop. Then you get on another taxi, and he runs his route to where you want to go. It's two stops, for example. So you actively participate in that. You become a participant observer. When you go and even like with worship, you go to a church or group of believers in a foreign country, and they're worshiping the Lord, and they're worshiping the Lord in ways, you know, they're dancing around in ways that you don't feel comfortable with. You know, maybe during the worship, if you go to an African church, they tend to dance around a lot in an African church. You just stand there and look at it. I mean, it's good to be an active observer, but at some point, if you want to bond with those people, what do you need to do? Get out there and dance around with them. It feels goofy and stuff, but you know what? You're actively participating then. You're bonding with the culture. And they notice those kind of things. They notice those kind of things. Have you ever brought any of your loved ones who don't know the Lord to a worship service? Maybe here or whatever, and they go into worship, and you know, half the people that are there are raising their hands, their eyes are closed, and you look at your loved one and they're standing there looking around, you know. You're going, they look like a fish out of water. You know? But if you see them close their eyes, raise their hands, try to worship along with everybody else, it makes them more acceptable to you. It's pleasing. Why? Because they're trying to participate in the way life is for us. Okay? So you have interactive observation. Participant observers. Okay? Third thing. The third proper response besides active observation and then interactive observation is be an inquirer and a listener. And we talked about this a little bit, I think, the first day of class. But be a listener. Be an inquirer. Because to be a listener and to be an inquirer means your mind is engaged. It means your mind is engaged. Okay? If you're doing an outline form, that would be number three. Under A, subpoint would be ask sensitive questions of the people that you're ministering to. Ask them questions like what, when, how, which, what do you, like, you know, like what do you do? When do you do it? How do you do it? Can you help me understand why you do it? What it means? See, what's happening then is you are engaging the culture. You've observed actively. You've become interactive. But now, the next step of being interactive is you've put yourself in the position of being a learner. Okay? Now, did I talk about that the first day of class or not? The most important thing for a short-term team member, if you're going to go on a short-term team, don't always be the one teaching. Be a listener. Ask questions. Let them talk. Find an area that they know something about and you don't, and ask them to tell you about it. Now, what that does then, what that does when you do that is it helps you to bond with them because they see that there's areas that, you know, they know more about than you do. And the reason this helps you out of this disenchantment phase is because it puts you in the position of a learner. It's hard not to be, it's hard not to move forward if you put yourself in a position of a learner, of an inquirer, somebody who inquires. Because you're gathering new information. And the more they talk, get this, the more they talk, this is where they live, the more they talk, the more you're going to understand about where you live now. And the more you know about where you live now, the more confident you're going to be that you can live there. A lot of the disenchantment comes from, I don't think I'm ever going to learn this. I don't think I'm ever going to adjust to this. I don't understand this. It makes no sense. When you ask those questions, you're assimilating information about them and their culture. The more familiar you become with it, the easier it is to live within it. And disenchantment goes out the door because that one major thing of anxiety, which leads to stress, is taken away.